This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the legal and public health issues of isolation and quarantine during the COVID-19 pandemic. Northeastern Professor Wendy Parmet and ACLU Senior Policy Analyst Jay Stanley discuss possible civil liberties violations when the government reacts with fear instead of with scientific facts. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Quarantine is a state, period, or place of isolation in which people or animals that have arrived from elsewhere or who've been exposed to infectious or contagious disease are placed. As Law and Disorder taped the show in early March 2020, thousands of people around the globe are being quarantined as governments rush to keep the COVID-19 virus from spreading. In China, for example, thousands were forced into mass quarantine centers. And entire cities and towns in Italy were put on lockdown, sending an estimated 100,000 persons into quarantine. In the United States, quarantines are being readied for some first responders. 24 emergency workers are being monitored for possible exposure to the coronavirus. And 27 firefighters and 2 police officers were quarantined in Washington State. Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire show to examining the civil liberties aspects of quarantines and other government responses to pandemics. The word quarantine and the practice dates back to the Middle Ages. It was used in 1617 to refer to the 40 days that a ship suspected of carrying a contagious disease was detained offshore in isolation. But the first instance of the institutionalized practice of quarantine actually occurred in the 14th century when the bubonic plague, also referred to as Black Death, devastated Europe from 1347 to 1352, killing approximately 20 million people. Authorities in Venice were the first to formalize a protective action after the plague began spreading there in 1347. Ports were closed to ships and travelers who had to spend the 40 days in isolation. In the early days in the United States, local and state jurisdictions were responsible for protection against contagious diseases. After a 1793 yellow fever epidemic struck Philadelphia and killed 5,000, the city created a 10-acre quarantine station called the Lazaretto along the Delaware River. With outbreaks of yellow fever continuing, Congress passed the National Quarantine Act in 1878, marking the federal government's involvement with quarantine activities. The quarantine system was fully nationalized by 1921, according to the Centers for Disease Control. Joining us today to talk about current quarantine efforts in the wake of COVID-19 is Professor Wendy Parmet from Northeastern Law School. Wendy is a leading expert in health, disability, and public health law, and directs the Law School's Center for Health Policy and Law. She holds a joint appointment with Northeastern School of Public Policy and Urban Affairs in recognition of her national leadership in interdisciplinary thinking and problem-solving on healthcare issues. Wendy co-edits the law school's SSRN online publications, Human Rights and the Global Economy, and the Northeastern University School of Law Public Law and Legal Theory paper series. In 2016, Wendy was honored with the prestigious J. Healy Health Law Teachers Award by the American Society of Law, Medicine, and Ethics. Wendy, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The public is hearing a lot about the words isolation and quarantine right now. Can you tell us what the difference is between the two?
Sure. But before I do, I think it's worth noting that the terms are often used interchangeably, even when they shouldn't be, right? So when we talk about isolation, precisely what we are referring to is the separation of an individual who has been diagnosed with an infectious disease. So you're isolating known patients in contrast, quarantine is the separation of an individual or groups or even a community of people who we think have been exposed and we're concerned that they might become infectious, but they're not actually known to be infectious. But again, caution, because a lot of people, and even our laws, often use the words interchangeably, and the term quarantine is often used casually to refer to both circumstances, though technically we should distinguish the two.
As you were speaking, I was thinking of movies where you're in a hospital and someone who's either been exposed to, you know, a deadly virus or maybe has tuberculosis is sort of in a glass room and you have to go in with protective gear. Is that accurate to be called isolation in that?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, that's isolation.
Perfect. Now, when can a government, be it federal or state, lawfully authorize either isolation or quarantine?
So we probably need to distinguish the federal government and the states because their powers are different. So the federal government has, by statute, fairly broad quarantine powers. And interestingly, the quarantine power, surprise, surprise, includes the power to isolate and also to block from travel. And under a federal statute, for example, the government can apprehend, detain, or conditionally release somebody for the purpose of preventing the introduction or spread of a communicable disease. And the key part of the federal quarantine power, as opposed to the states, is that it's limited to prevent the spread of the disease from foreign countries into the United States or from one state to other states, right? So the federal authority is at the border, and it's to protect interstate transmission. The states, which have traditionally really taken the lead and played the primary role in quarantine inside the country, have what are known as police powers. And, you know, the exact standards will vary by state. Many of us will say that as a constitutional matter, these, you know, the states need good reasons to quarantine somebody, that probably it should be only when it is the least restrictive alternative and in the least restrictive manner possible. But the actual contours of the state's police powers and quarantine powers will vary both by state statute and by case law.
Now, you have written about this, and I believe in one of your articles you talked about the effectiveness or lack thereof of quarantine. Can you talk about whether it works as a measure of stopping the spread of a disease?
So, you know, it's a difficult question to answer because, first, we're talking about many different kinds of quarantines. Quarantines come in really different flavors, so to speak. You know, there's the quarantine of an individual in their home. There's quarantines in institutional settings. There's quarantines, we use that term too, when you cordon off a city, for example. And so all of these are really different. And, of course, diseases are really different, right? Ebola is not measles, is not SARS, it's not COVID-19. And so all of these are different, and the efficacy and impact of quarantine is going to be different in all of those circumstances. What I do think it's important to recognize is that while quarantine can be a helpful tool, it's a good thing to have when done right in the public health toolkit. It's not the magic bullet, except in very limited circumstances. It's certainly not going to be the magic bullet for COVID-19. You know, what we need to talk about, I think, is how do we maximize efficacy, both of quarantine, but also, more importantly, in conjunction with a wide range of other interventions. You know, we can't just quarantine our way out of this. It's just not practical once a disease, a respiratory disease, becomes widely dispersed in a community?
I'm wondering out loud here whether in its haste to appear to be responding rapidly to this virus, maybe the government sometimes invokes the notion of quarantine, or actually does it in order to look as though it's being proactive. Is that, would you say there's any accuracy to that?
Well, certainly the historical record supports that. You know, in 2014, several states, usually led by governors who held press conferences, instituted quarantines for people coming back from West Africa. This was did not follow CDC guidelines. This was certainly contra, you know, against all the best science for a whole lot of reasons. But it made them look like they were being tough on Ebola. You know, the public was scared. Ebola is scary. And there was, you know, the media was filled with stories about the dangers of Ebola. And so we had these quarantines that were really, in retrospect, they were political stunts. So it's important to understand that quarantines can be done that way. Quarantines are often also historically applied disproportionately and often in ugly manners, you know, against vulnerable populations. We've had racially based quarantines. We've had quarantines in this country, or maybe more precisely, isolation. At one time, where, you know, women who were thought to be of questionable morals, as the terms were used, were rounded up. I mean, we need to be cognizant of that history. We need to recognize that it doesn't mean that it's never an appropriate tool now, but we can't forget that history. And the last thing I guess I want to say to this particular question is, again, quarantine, even when it is useful, it's not like, okay, I quarantined that one person. The people from the Diamond Princess are on an Air Force base. Job well done. End of problem, right? I mean, quarantine may play a role, but there's a lot of other things we should be doing. And quarantine, like travel bans, are mostly ways of buying time, especially for a disease such as COVID-19, a respiratory disease. They buy you a little bit of time. And so whether quarantine is worth it kind of depends on whether you're using the time bought wisely or foolishly.
I want to just go back quickly to your mention of that quarantine of women. I believe that was related to venereal disease back in World War
II. They were called, yeah. Right. Yeah, now we would call it sexually transmitted diseases, but yeah. And it was pretty common in the United States, especially around World War I, but continuing for several decades thereafter. And, you know, women were hauled in, held, treated, often against their will and often without diagnosis. And, of course, what's interesting about that is that this form of forced isolation and forced medical treatment, these were called hold and treat laws, were almost never applied to men. It was like, you know, we'll just take care of the women and somehow the disease will go away. And, you know, it's an example of a very gendered, discriminatory application of this police power.
Right. And I understand there were quarantine hospitals set up then, which is bringing me to my next question. In modern day, where are people physically put in quarantine? Are there special centers that we've not heard about?
Long ago, in the Middle Ages and during the Renaissance, and you know, even through the 19th century, it was very common to have quarantine hospitals, often called pest houses, where people were sent. And these were very dangerous places, and they're kind of where you're sent to die. Fortunately, these are less common today. They're not very common, but there certainly are examples. At least from press reports, it appears that China has been using this. There certainly was some use of this during the SARS epidemic, where you just sort of take people and you congregate them in a place where people are under quarantine or are put together. And it's really, really dangerous, right? Because you're taking, you know, maybe depending on the circumstance, you know, you're taking a lot of people who, in fact, were not infectious, and you're mixing them in a room with people who are infectious, right? You know, smart move. You make a bad situation worse. You know, in recent practice in the U.S., where we haven't had a lot of quarantines, quarantines have primarily been in people's homes. People have been quarantined in homes. And people certainly are often frequently asked voluntarily, not legally imposed, subject to legally imposed quarantines in their homes. But in 2014, for example, nurse Casey Hickox was quarantined for some period of time in a tent outside of a hospital in Newark for Ebola, which she never had. So quarantines can be, again, they just come in a lot of flavors. You know, it's like the Baskin-Robbins ice cream. And as much as possible, it's really important for these to be effective for people to be in the least restrictive setting, to be in the most comfortable setting. People are much more willing to abide by quarantine, not run from it, not head for the hills to try to escape it, if they're going to be comfortable and their basic needs are met. Are you going to tell them that as of Monday, people will be taken to the quarantine hospital? What you'll see is people will run for it, as they did in SARS in China and Beijing in 2003.
Yes, and I think that transparency, giving them as much information in advance, must also make people want to participate if they understand why they're being asked and what the parameters are going to be. That brings me to the issue of privacy and medical records. Say this is the current situation, mushrooms to larger numbers being tested, and I guess that's also a question I wanted to ask you about involuntary testing. But do you foresee privacy with medical records being an issue in this?
So state public health agencies actually have a really good, not 100% perfect, but a darn good track record of respecting people's privacy. But on the other hand, you know, the names of some of the folks quarantined for Ebola do get out to the press, and that was deeply troubling. You know, there were stories, and people were stigmatized and ostracized. So I do think it's an issue, and it's something, you know, we need to consider and be sensitive about.
Can the government force us to be screened? So, for example, people getting off airplanes, might we expect to see measures like that?
Well, the government has already instituted and has done it in other times, a sort of non-invasive screening, and the CDC can do this. It's in its regulations, so, you know, they can do temperature checks and things like that. Beginning to feel like that with COVID-19, that's of quite limited efficacy, although, you know, again, we are still in the fog of war stage with this virus. But they can do that, and they do that. Under the CDC's quarantine regulations, they can do medical examinations, which would include diagnostic, although they need informed consent. But then, you know, here's the rub. They can keep holding you until they know, right? So it's a little bit like the hold and treat. You know, if you test negative, you're free to go. You don't have to have the invasive blood test or something, but you can be kept for, right? So there's a little bit of that going on. In terms of the states, it will vary by state law. I mean, we do have strong principles of informed consent and not conducting invasive procedures on people. You know, the nasal swab is somewhere in between the most invasive and not. And there are Fourth Amendment issues, but there's not a lot of Fourth Amendment case law explored in the infectious disease scenario.
Oh, can we just talk, Wendy, briefly about the name of this? A lot of people are calling it the coronavirus. Some are calling it COVID-19. I've heard also that it's a new form of virus. What is the proper terminology?
Well, I'm not the end-all and be-all. It is a coronavirus, but there are other coronaviruses. You know, SARS was a coronavirus. Some forms of the common cold are caused by coronaviruses. So it's a coronavirus.
I'm just curious. This is your area of expertise in terms of healthcare, quarantines. Is this something that you teach at Northeastern?
Yeah, well, I teach a course called Problems in Public Health Law, and we spend time on emerging infectious diseases and quarantine and isolation and the case law and the regulations. So, yeah, I've been teaching this for quite some time. Obviously, I'm not teaching this semester, so I haven't taught this outbreak. But we usually, you know, we look at SARS and Ebola, and response is to similar diseases.
Wendy, I want to talk briefly about the current administration in terms of a focus perhaps less on civil liberties, more on police powers in very general terms. The president can change the director of the CDC if he wants to without Senate confirmation.
The president certainly has authority. It's an executive branch. It's a subdivision of the Department of Health and Human Services. Actually, the firing would have to go through the Secretary of HHS. But it's an executive agency. And so it's not an independent agency. So the president has great authority. But a permanent, I think it's a confirmed position.
And I'm thinking in many other issues, not healthcare, but you know, related to war powers. We've seen the president basically do what he wants, not necessarily based on the facts. It would seem to me that with a public health emergency, it's especially important the president be informed about the facts.
Well, it's absolutely essential in a situation as we're in now that the president be informed and that he communicate what is known based on the best evidence, clearly, that he gives the good news and the bad news, because people need to have trust in the information they're getting. To the extent that there's bad news, it helps if you're getting it right from leadership in a way that explains it and explains what the response will be, as opposed to getting it through, you know, rumors on Twitter, right? That's really not good. This is a time in which we really need clear, accurate, and frequent information. And leadership from the highest levels, you know, from the president to state and local health officials. We need clear messaging. That's absolutely critical. You need it through any emergency or disaster, just as you would go deal and try to get clear information from during a hurricane or in the aftermath of a terrorist attack or during a war. I've been thinking a lot about how nations, you know, that have lived through war, you know, Churchill and the Battle of Britain. You want clear information. You don't want it sugar-coated. You don't want false assurances. And that actually can make people less frightened. You know, if they know they're being told everything's okay when they know it's not okay, that's not usually very helpful.
Wendy, in situations like this, typically we see certain communities stigmatized. Can you talk about that in this case and generally in pandemics?
Well, it's an unfortunate and common feature of human response to pandemics that communities have been stigmatized and scapegoated. You know, when bubonic plague struck medieval Europe, communities responded by instituting pogroms. And when bubonic plague came to Chinatown in 1900, there was very significant discrimination and discriminatory quarantines instituted against the Chinese American community. When HIV emerged in the 1980s, there was significant discrimination against people, gay men, Haitians, people with hemophilia, people who were in groups that were associated with the disease. This is unfortunately a well-known and troubling phenomena. It is counterproductive. Diseases, groups are not responsible for diseases, and stigmatizing groups often impedes effective and rational public health interventions, and of course it's also wrong on its own terms for violating the human rights of the people who are stigmatized. But unfortunately, it's common, and it's another place where we need leadership to make clear that groups of Americans, ethnic groups, racial groups, religious groups, they are not responsible for this disease. This is a problem that we are all facing. Anybody can get this disease, and anybody can spread it. So, avoiding Chinatown is not an effective response. It's just hurting a community. And if it makes somebody think that that makes them safe because they avoid Chinatown, they are deluding themselves.
In our couple of remaining minutes, Wendy, you mentioned the Fourth Amendment earlier. In your classes, do you talk about issues in this kind of scenario where our Fourth Amendment rights are violated?
Well, I do. We also talk a lot about the 14th Amendment. So, when these kind of situations arise, at least at the state level, we're talking about the Fourth and the 14th Amendment, the rights of due process, the rights of equal protection, right, to prevent discrimination, and certainly the Fourth Amendment rights of privacy and the right, to have a warrant before search and seizure. So, there are definitely important constitutional issues that are raised by quarantine, mandatory quarantine, compulsory isolation, or compulsory medical examinations. Lots of constitutional issues, some very clear constitutional guidelines, and then also a lot that we don't know because there hasn't been a lot of litigation on these issues, and the Supreme Court hasn't looked or talked about quarantine in a very, very long time.
Wendy, how can our listeners read your work or learn more about these topics online?
Sure. So the first thing I would suggest, instead of actually reading my work, although I'm always happy to, promote my own stuff, is along with some colleagues at Yale and Temple, we drafted the other day an open letter to Vice President Pence and other federal and state officials on what we believe are the essential ingredients to a effective response to the current outbreak. At least as of this morning, over 700 experts in public health and law have signed the letter. You can find it just by Googling open letter Yale. It's because it's being housed on the Yale web page. Actually, let me put it this way. I urge people to read it because I believe in it, but I also, it makes me feel better, right? Because it shows that there are things we can do. There's no magic bullet. There's no wonder, quarantine miracle. But there are steps that can be taken, not complicated, not rocket science, that can help us manage this crisis and weather this storm. So if you're only going to read one thing, I urge you to read the open letter to Vice President Pence. I can share other sites, but I really, that's the one I would urge right now.
We can put a link to that on
that would be
our
fabulous.
Website. Yes.
That would be fabulous.
Wendy Parmet, it's been really a joy to talk to you about not the cheeriest of subjects, but you've helped illuminate it for our listeners. And we want to thank you so much for the important work that you're doing and for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
More than 450 public health experts recently urged government leaders to enact scientifically informed policies to mitigate the effects of the COVID-19 coronavirus in the U.S. They called for fair and equitable imposition of such policies. According to the ACLU, the experts' recommendations, sent in a public letter, could help ensure a response plan that protects the health, safety, and civil liberties of all. It's generally accepted that during a disease outbreak, individual rights may have to cede to give way to the greater good. But that is only if science supports the need for such measures, which may include isolation and quarantine. In their letter, the public health experts ask officials, for example, to work with insurance companies to guarantee that lack of insurance and high costs are not a barrier to testing and treatment. They call for healthcare facilities to be dubbed, quote, immigration enforcement-free zones, a step that was used earlier during hurricanes and other emergencies. And the public health officials also seek assistance for under-resourced hospitals and community health centers. Also impacted are minimum wage workers and those who live on the economic margins, those who can't telecommute or can't afford to lose their jobs. The experts also stress that leaders need to scrupulously ensure that their public messages are accurate and guided by science rather than politics. In the past, many responses to emergencies have been hindered by politics, including China's response to the SARS coronavirus outbreak in 2003. Joining us today to discuss what can happen if politics trump public health is Jay Stanley, senior policy analyst at the ACLU Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project in Washington, D.C. Jay Stanley, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Jay, we're about 3 months into public awareness of the COVID-19 coronavirus. What was one of the first signs that you saw in the U.S. that our leaders might be politicizing their response?
Well, it's interesting. I think that one of the big fears when this started is that the Trump administration would be excessively alarmist. Because of President Trump's personal history during the 2014-2015 Ebola scare, Ebola outbreak in Africa, in which he was very, very alarmist, made a number of unscientifically supported statements, and so forth. Ironically, if anything, the administration has gone to the other extreme, saying that nobody should worry about anything, that the issue is being overblown and so forth. So I think, you know, that there's a history there in that emergencies are always exploited by various parties for their own particular ends. We saw that at 9/11. We've seen that in other emergencies. And more recently, we are seeing the issue politicized around various border agendas, calls to close the Mexican border, even though there's zero reason to think that there are any more cases, if any, coming from Mexico or Latin America than there are from other places around the world, a growing list of countries around the world, and putting in place travel restrictions that seem to have other agendas behind them. One of the things that the experts say is that as we move from localized outbreaks to general community transmission, in which we're not putting out sparks that are landing here from abroad, but we're having the virus spread around communities within the United States, those kinds of travel bans make less and less sense, and that policymakers need to shift gears from one of trying to keep the virus out and imposing quarantines and so forth to a whole separate set of public policy responses that involve acknowledging that it's circulating throughout the community, that transmission can be slowed, but it cannot be stopped.
In 2008, the ACLU issued a report called Pandemic Preparedness: The Need for a Public Health, Not a Law Enforcement National Security Approach. And the report noted that coercion and brute force are rarely necessary and are actually counterproductive in this kind of situation. Tell us about some of the measures that a, quote, law enforcement government might take. For example, could we see forced vaccinations if they come up with a vaccine, or mandatory testing?
Yeah, those are both things that we could see. Again, you could see quarantines that are not quarantines that scientists say will be effective, but that are imposed by political leaders out of their desire to look tough and to look as if they're taking vigorous action. And you can see those quarantines imposed with, you know, law enforcement and military might, and not imposed in a humanitarian way that it means that make sure that people who are under quarantine are actually supported. Are they going to get fired from their jobs? They have food and childcare and medicine, access to information, et cetera, et cetera. And so, you know, a quarantine can be justified in certain specific circumstances, although the experts say that typically it's not effective in stopping the spread of the disease, only in delaying it, although delay can be important. But unjustified quarantines are one example where we might see that. And again, forced treatment and in general an attitude of expecting people not to cooperate with the authorities and therefore treating individuals as presumptive enemies, which alienates them from the public authorities, drives them underground, and generally has been found by experts throughout history to be counterproductive.
Let's talk a minute about airport screenings, detention, the right to counsel. I know that in 2017, the CDC passed rules that expanded its powers to screen, test, and quarantine people traveling into or within the U.S. in the event of a crisis like the Ebola outbreak. Are there dangers with letting the CDC have expanded powers? I don't believe there's a limit, for example, to how long one can be detained, although I may be wrong about that.
Yeah, I mean, we've generally seen, and we saw during the Bush years, before the Ebola scares, a push for greater authorities by state and local governments and the CDC in these kinds of emergencies. Authorities that were greater than necessary and authorities that were not restrained by the kind of due process checks and balances that are required. But in general, you know, as our founding fathers talked about, you know, if we were governed by angels, we wouldn't need checks and balances on government power. And public health emergency authorities are government power, and they can be abused just like any other. And certainly one of the lessons in the Ebola scare of 2014 and 2015 is that when there's a conflict between what the scientists and the experts are saying is scientifically and medically justified and what politicians want to do in response to public fear, potentially public ignorance, and a desire to be seen as quote-unquote tough, the politicians will plow ahead and ignore the scientific experts. And that is why it's important that all these laws have due process protection so that somebody, for example, who is ordered to be quarantined can, if they think that quarantine is ridiculous and unsupported, can challenge their detention in court.
Jay, recently a group of several hundred public health experts urged government leaders to examine science in formulating policies to basically mitigate the effects of the COVID-19 coronavirus, and they called for a fair and equitable imposition of such policies. Can you talk about that letter and why it's important?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I mean, at the ACLU, we're an individual rights organization. We defend individuals' rights. But even we recognize that in a disease outbreak, individualism at some level breaks down because we're all one big biomass. And therefore, you can be detained through quarantine without, even though you've committed no crime and have not had a trial by a jury and so forth. But the flip side of that is that individualism also breaks down in the other direction, which is that diseases don't care who has health insurance. They don't care who has privilege. And they don't care who is documented or undocumented. At a bio level, we are all just organisms. And so you may have the best health insurance in the world, but if there are 30 million people in this country circulating around who do not have health insurance and as a result can't get tested and can't get treated for coronavirus, that is a healthcare problem for you. And so the point of the expert's letter was that if we're going to be effective at dealing with coronavirus and minimizing its spread and its consequences, we have to take care of those who are the most powerless and vulnerable people in our society, people in prisons, people who do not have health insurance, people who are undocumented and might fear that if they go to a hospital and seek treatment that they'll fall into the hands of an ICE officer, people who are minimum wage and gig workers. They can't just telecommute and work, you know, work from home the way an affluent office worker might be able to do if they think that they're sick. If they don't show up for work, they lose their job. If we want to be effective as a society in addressing and minimizing this pandemic, we need to address all those problems. We need to think through it, and we need to provide the resources for it. And so that's what the experts were saying. It's a very important message that this is a case where the need to address the outbreak and the need to be fair and equitable are one and the same thing.
I know that one of the things the letter mentioned was not having a lack of insurance or high costs be a barrier to testing and treatment. I know that New York State has said that no one will be, I believe, no one will be charged for being tested. Seems like that would be a good measure to put in place nationally.
Absolutely. It's vital to put that kind of a measure in place because the current healthcare system that we have puts us in a very poor position to deal with a disease that doesn't care who's got insurance and who doesn't and what kind of insurance that you may have.
Jay, you mentioned different communities, especially communities that aren't as affluent as others, being disproportionately impacted. And we know that we've seen already stigma attached to Asian communities, blame perhaps being brought really without reason. And I know that, of course, the ACLU handles cases that relate to different communities being treated without due process. How do you see this playing out over the next weeks and months? If it worsens, just give us your worst case scenario for civil liberties in this country that could play out in terms of government policies and restrictions on, say, communities of color.
Well, I think the worst case scenario would be that the government fails to provide support to lesser resourced institutions, hospitals, nursing homes, prisons, and that the burdens and the toll of this outbreak fall heavily on all of those areas. You know, I mean, there's a whole history in outbreaks of stigmatization being attached to, especially where an outbreak starts. I mean, it never makes any sense, but it especially doesn't make sense when it's already in widespread transmission. A lot of the difference between whether people react in those kind of ugly ways and whether they not is leadership. It's political leadership. It's government authorities who speak openly and honestly and clearly about the risks and the lack of risks and the fact that there are no particular groups that this disease, you know, is attached to. I'm not sure how much room we have for optimism on that front, but that would certainly be the worst-case scenario, that the government actually foments instead of dampening the tendency for stigmatization to emerge, and fails to take measures to make sure that communities and institutions and don't have the resources they need to take care of it.
Jay, in a recent statement you made in early February, you said that these measures are extraordinary incursions on liberty and fly in the face of considerable evidence that travel bans and quarantines can do more harm than good, including studies from the World Health Organization itself. Can you expand on that a bit for our listeners?
Yeah, I think that the general consensus among epidemiologists that we've talked to and read of is that quarantines in some circumstances can delay the spread of disease, and that delay can be very important because it gives time for hospitals and other institutions to prepare. But that we have to understand that their effect will be relatively limited, and B, only make sense in certain circumstances. We saw quarantines with Ebola where they did not make any scientific sense, and yet still were pushed by politicians looking to do something, anything. And the reason they didn't make sense in Ebola is because Ebola is not contagious until after symptoms start, in some cases well after symptoms start. Whereas that's not the case with this virus. Every virus is different, and so you have to adapt. But there was plenty of reason to worry at the very outset when I made that statement that government officials would not be bound by scientific advice, but would go off and put in place quarantines just for the sake of looking tough. The World Health Organization discourages travel bans because in the past, particular countries where an outbreak of one kind or another have started have been slapped with travel bans by the rest of the world, and that has created a strong incentive for countries to hide incipient outbreaks rather than seek help from the global public health community in squelching them. You know, and obviously travel bans are enormously economically and socially disruptive. They tend to hurt the weakest people the most, people who can ill afford to make up for the disruptions. And so that's where we were coming from on that.
Jay, can you tell our listeners about the ACLU's Speech, Privacy, and Technology Project?
Yeah, so we are a legal project within the ACLU that focuses on new technologies and their effect on our privacy and other civil liberties and on the First Amendment and free speech, and which is closely related to privacy and closely related these days to technology, of course, but we cover all free speech issues. Part of our portfolio is, you know, not just technology but also science, which includes communicable diseases. And so we did a major report in cooperation with the Yale School of Public Health and the Yale Law School on the government's response to the 2014-2015 Ebola outbreak, and have worked on communicable diseases over the years.
What are some of the lessons that came out of the Ebola outbreak that we could take as instructive on how to deal better with the current situation?
I think the Ebola outbreak was a much different thing. I think a lot of the what was happening with Ebola was public fear, and that there was never really a serious chance that Ebola was going to begin transmitting within the community in the United States. This is a much more serious public health emergency from what the experts are saying. We don't know exactly how bad it will be, but it's very possible that it will be quite bad. We can hope that it will not be. I think that one of the lessons with Ebola, from my perspective, is certainly that government officials will respond to public fear and public panic. Some government officials will not respond well, and they will act in ways that do not comport with what science says is necessary. And if you're restricting people's liberties in ways that are not scientifically justified, that's a civil liberties incursion. And so we need to be vigilant to make sure that the authorities don't violate civil liberties in that way. And that's bad because it's bad to violate civil liberties, but it's also bad because it's a waste of time and it's counterproductive to actually limiting the spread of the disease.
Do you anticipate any lawsuits coming to the ACLU out of this epidemic?
We'll have to see if there's egregious behavior that merits a lawsuit. We can hope that the experts' letter, which has now been signed by over 700 public health experts, will pressure and encourage public health authorities around the country to act within science and within the law. It's a big country. A lot of this is done locally, so there's a good chance that at least some state and local officials will act egregiously, and in that case, we'll have to take a look and see what we think.
In your recent work, does any other country stand out as having a good record for handling public health emergencies like this effectively and based on science?
There have been a range of responses around the world. Many countries around the world have taken steps that we should consider, such as guaranteeing paid sick leave, making sure that insurance coverage is not a barrier to stopping spread of the disease, widespread and efficient testing, and so forth. And I think that it's a good idea for American officials to look abroad and see the kinds of bold steps, good steps, steps to help people who are among the most vulnerable people in our society, and helping those people is good for all of us.
The letter that the public health expert signed was to Vice President Pence, wasn't it?
I believe it was addressed to Vice President Pence and other officials dealing with the outbreak.
And has that been transmitted already?
Yes.
Okay. Is the ACLU going to be following up with any kind of educational campaign or advocacy work?
Well, we have been trying to spread word about what the experts have said. I put up a post on the ACLU's blog, and we have been working through our state affiliates to get the letter and the message that it contains into the hands of local officials.
Jay, as our time runs out, unfortunately, can you give us a brief summary of what you're working on other than this issue?
Yeah, so I do a lot of work, not just on science issues like communicable diseases, but also on privacy and technology issues. I am looking at technologies such as face recognition, such as video analytics, which uses AI to monitor video feeds. Aerial surveillance and drones is an area that I've been doing research in, as well as issues like school surveillance, identity issues, and commercial privacy. The range of very scary privacy challenges that we face in today's world of lightning-fast technology change.
To be made even faster with 5G networks, correct?
That's what they say.
Yeah. How can our listeners follow you and learn more about your work on a regular basis?
Well, I am on Twitter at J.C. Stanley, J-A-Y-C Stanley. I write frequent blog posts on the ACLU's blog, which you can find online, about privacy and technology issues. Like those would be the best two ways.
Well, you cover some of our favorite topics here on Law and Disorder. So it's really been a pleasure to chat with you today, Jay, and keep up the great work.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being on.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.